I'm Ramon Stoppelenberg, and this is number 0309, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0309. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, NASA historian Rod Pyle is back on the show to talk about NASA's Horizons mission to Pluto.
Looking at the surface and some of the stuff on the surface and doing other measurements, it's clear that there's a layer of what appears to be liquid water between a rocky core and an icy crust. So it's this weird thing out there in the cold darkness, but it still apparently has a liquid ocean. So the thinking is there's enough radioactivity left in the rocky core that it's keeping that water warm enough not to freeze. And of course, where you've got liquid water, you may have life. So, you know, once we can get out to these places and start drilling through the ice and sending something down, looking around, who knows what we're going to find. There may be life all over the solar system. We just don't know.
Tech expert Mark Saltzman is the author of Apple Watch for Dummies.
Another example or application is directions. If you are trying to find, you know, if you parked your car and you're trying to get to a meeting, you can ask your watch, take me to such and such address or such and such business. And not only will it give you turn-by-turn directions that you can glance at on your wrist with a map, but you can actually feel vibrations on your wrist that tell you when to turn left or right. You don't even need to look down at all. So pretty cool stuff that a lot of people don't know about.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, Stephen King strikes again with his latest thriller, Finders Keepers. So don't be a loser weeper. It's all happening soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0309 was Ramon Stoppelenberg, a very busy entrepreneur in Phnom Penh. He runs three movie houses there called The Flicks. He has an online event guide called Lady Pen, which lets you know all the things you can do in Phnom Penh, besides going to his three movie houses, of course. And if that's not enough, starting August the 1st, he'll host a radio show every Saturday. As a matter of fact, here's a promo for his radio show.
Coming up next month is the Radio 1 Rock Show, focusing on today's best rock music and the blasts from the past. Every Saturday from 7 to 9 p.m. on Radio 1 Cambodia. And it's hosted by me, Ramon Rocklenberg. The Rock Show, coming soon.
A very, very, very busy guy, which is why I'm very glad that he found the time to do the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. And by the way, you can check out all of the websites to all of his ventures, or at least the three I mentioned, because he's got so many going. You can go to the Stuff File page, go to the What's On page for the show, which you just heard Ramon say a few moments ago, 0309, and you'll find the link. And again, Ramon, thank you for taking some time out of your very, very busy day to do the guest slate on this program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Among the protesters at New York City's Gay Pride Parade after the Supreme Court's historic gay marriage decision was a group of men outfitted in Jewish prayer garments and representing the Jewish Political Action Committee, carrying signs reading, for example, "Judaism prohibits homosexuality." However, the men were very likely not Jewish, but in fact, Mexican laborers hired for the day. A representative of the committee told the New York Times that the men were supplemental, necessary because the committee's rabbis would not permit their students, who normally staff such protests, to be exposed to the sights of same-sex exuberance typical of the parade. Oh, the irony of outsourcing. Does Donald Trump know about this while he's on the campaign trail? Yeah. Meanwhile, WOOD-TV in Grand Rapids, Michigan, seemingly uncovered an antiquity, if not a potential vulnerability, in the Grand Rapids public school system in June, when it reported that the heating and cooling systems at 19 schools are controlled using a Commodore Amiga computer released back in the 1980s. You remember the 1980s, right? About the same time as Windows 2.0, I may add. Operating on an early internet modem, it had been installed by a computer-savvy student and, according to the maintenance supervisor, still works fine, thank you very much. Fortunately, the supervisor said, the student still lives in the area and is available if problems arise. See? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. There is no need for constantly upgrading, said the guy who was still working on two computers, one with Windows XP and the other with Windows Vista. Yeah, I raised my hand. Okay, let's check out the animal world. If you go to Wired.com, they have a thing in their site, or on their site, Absurd Creature of the Week. This is one of the entries for June, which is rather bizarre, and I guess, according to the headline, absurd. It's a bearded, or beaded rather, lacewing that preys on termites by first immobilizing them with a vapor phase toxicant released from its anus. Now, the silent but deadly gas is reportedly powerful enough to disable six ordinary termites for up to 3 hours, which is plenty of time for a sumptuous meal of termite, and weaken several more that might get caught in the, you know, the backdraft. Wired.com also learned of the related species, Chrysoperla comanche, whose anal weaponry is in solid form, wielded by master contortionists who lift their abdomens in order to reach direct contact with their victims' heads. Wow, I think I was once in an elevator with that guy. Yeah. Moving right along, Cy Allen arrested in March in Colchester, England, on suspicion of possessing drugs with intent to sell, relied on a fairly common strategy. As officers burst into the room, he swallowed the evidence. As in other cases, police decided to wait for nature to take its course in order to recover the suspected drugs. Unlike in other cases, Allen managed to hold out with no bowel movement for 23 days. But not on his 24th. He was arrested. Wow. 23 days. Now there's a guy who definitely needs some fiber in his diet, huh? Okay, this next story is something I've been talking about ad infinitum for the better part of two decades now, but no one's listening to me. In June, research scientists from Britain's University of Exeter and Queen Mary University of London warned that owners of domestic cats seem not, on average, to appreciate what vicious killers their pets are and urge, for instance, that they be kept indoors more often lest they disseminate the neighborhood's bird and small mammal populations. Estimates of a yearly death toll generated by house cats are in the magnitude of millions in the United Kingdom and billions in the United States. See, like I said, I've been saying this for years. Cats are evil, little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. And it's just a matter of time before they train their sights on human prey. They are clearly plotting against mankind. I keep repeating this message to deaf ears, but one day you'll all realize that I am right about this. And of course, at that point, it will be too late. That's all I'm saying. And while we're still on animals, in the UK, a drunk squirrel has been causing hundreds of pounds of damage at a private members club. The secretary of the Honeybourne Railway Club said he originally thought someone had broken into the premises near Evesham in Worcestershire. The floor was covered in beer and glass and bottles smashed, according to Sam Bolter. Bolter said that he then saw a squirrel staggering around after coming out from behind a box of crisps. That's what they call potato chips, folks. He had turned on the taps, he added. There were bottles scattered around, money scattered around, and he had obviously run across the bar's pumps and managed to turn on the Caffrey tap. He must have flung himself on the handle and drunk some as he was staggering around all over the place and moving a bit slowly. I've never seen a drunk squirrel before. He was sozzled and looked a bit worse for wear, shall we say. Bolter, who estimated he lost about 300 pounds in the incident, eventually caught the squirrel in a waste paper bin and released him out the window. Well, that's mighty nice of him. I guess he didn't have a cat to sick on it. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the Common Council in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, voted on an ordinance to amend its municipal code to clarify what animals qualify as a service animal to aid the handicapped. Specially trained dogs and miniature horses are in, if a doctor prescribes them, but kangaroos are out. The city attorney noted such an ordinance is legal since, according to the Americans with Disabilities Act, pets who merely provide emotional comfort do not qualify as service animals. The action was taken because a woman bought a young roo into a restaurant, claiming she was disabled and that the joey was her therapy animal, but refused to say what medical doctor authorized it. The ordinance passed, by the way, 14-0 in the vote. Now, I'm sorry, but in the middle of Wisconsin, just where does one even get a kangaroo? I mean, it's not exactly something you would find on Craigslist, is it? Is it? I don't know. I haven't checked Craigslist recently. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the program, shall we? It has taken 9 years to reach its destination, but New Horizons, the first spacecraft to journey to Pluto, has made it and is now sending back the first close-up pictures of the former planet ever taken. NASA historian Rod Pyle is back on the show to talk about the mission. He joins us on the line from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on with us once again. So the first thing I want to ask about, you know, now that Pluto's in the news, now that everyone's talking about it, now that NASA's excited, there are some folks that are saying, well, maybe we should rethink this idea about it not being a planet anymore.
Yes. Well, and you know, and they're all emailing the wonderful astronomer Mike Brown over at Caltech, who in 2005 was the guy responsible for demoting Pluto, but he's holding fast. And it's interesting because it actually is larger than we thought. You know, part of that whole discussion was when he discovered Eris, which is a much further but similar object out in the area called the Kuiper Belt, which is beyond the orbit of Neptune, that Eris was bigger. And so since Eris was a minor planet, ergo, so should Pluto be. And it turns out that Pluto's, in terms of diameter, a little bigger, but it's still less massive. So Pluto gets to stay a runt. It's going to stay a dwarf planet. Sorry.
Okay, so the mission itself, the New Horizons mission, how exciting or how excited is NASA about the pictures that we're finally seeing now?
Well, you know, it was a long wait because it made the encounter Tuesday morning, and it's a 4.5-hour wait to get the signals back because it's far away. You know, it's 3 billion miles away. So they had to wait that out. And then while the spacecraft is going past Pluto, it turns its radio dish away from Earth. So it sent back its last pre-encounter photo and turns its dish towards Pluto so it can do all the science work it's going to do as it's flying by. So we're out of contact because of that. And then finally, when that's over, it turns back, and there's another 4.5-hour wait. So it was last night in the evening before they even got just the basic heartbeat message and some telemetry saying, hey, I'm okay. I made it through the encounter and the flyby, and I'll send you a picture tomorrow.
And, when we're talking last night, we should clarify, because we're recording this, of course, we're talking Wednesday.
Right. Yeah. That was Tuesday. Yeah.
Exactly.
So that was exciting and that was great, but it was a radio show at that point, right? Just like we're doing now. So finally today, at Wednesday at noon Eastern time, NASA held a press conference and they showed the first picture, and it's going to get much better. That picture was still, I think, 500,000 miles out or something, and the closest approach was about 7,700 miles. So they're going to be able to resolve things as small as 230 feet wide once they get down those pictures at the closest approach. But what we got was sensational. Now, it's worth mentioning, you know, getting the data back is going to take all the data that it collected as it was passing Pluto is going to take 16 months to get back, because you're basically trying to put a fire hose through a soda straw. It's far away. It's got a small radio dish. It's got a limited amount of power from its nuclear generator. So it's going to take a long time to get the stuff back. But they did get one great picture, and it was sensational. We got mountains 11 to 12,000 feet high on the surface. It's clear that the surface of Pluto and Charon, its largest moon, is relatively young. It's maybe 50 to 100 million years old instead of the 4.5 billion years old of the solar system. So there's stuff going on out there. And they were just, I thought there was going to be a whole series of heart attacks up on the podium there, so excited.
So, considering how long it takes the information to get to us, it's like living with a dial-up again for the guys at NASA, right?
Yeah, it really, you know, somebody made that comparison. They said it's kind of like being in the old dial-up modem days where you're waiting for AOL to download one photograph for 3 minutes. But, you know, they're getting so much in each photo and each set of data that they bring down that it's well worth the wait. And there are surprises. I mean, there's a lot of surprises. They said that it's unlike anything else we've seen in the solar system and really completely exceeded what they came for.
Well, what I was going to ask is what is the biggest thing so far, and there's still so much information to glean from this, what's the biggest thing we've learned, or conversely, if it's not the same, what's the biggest misconception that's been thwarted by what we've learned so far?
Well, I guess you can kind of combine those two things. I mean, we're finding more and more there are these watery worlds out in the solar system, and probably in the other solar systems we're starting to see where the exoplanets live. So, you know, there are moons of Jupiter and Saturn that look like they are watery, but out there's a good reason for that, which is if you're orbiting one of these big, colossal, giant planets, there's gravity, which is squeezing and flexing these moons, and we think that's what causes what's called tidal heating, with a D, T-I-D-A-L, that makes these things keep liquid oceans. Pluto, as far as we knew for a long time, really had no business having a liquid ocean, but measurements seem to indicate that it might. And now that this craft has flown by, looking at the surface and some of the stuff on the surface and doing other measurements, it's clear that there's a layer of what appears to be liquid water between a rocky core and an icy crust. And that's kind of a surprise. So, especially because it's not being flexed by anything gravitationally, it's way out there all by itself, kind of beyond Neptune most of the time. Its orbit crosses over and above the equator of the solar system, if you will, called the ecliptic. So it's this weird thing out there in the cold darkness, but it still apparently has a liquid ocean. So the thinking is there's enough radioactivity left in the rocky core that it's keeping that water warm enough not to freeze. And of course, where you've got liquid water, as we've discussed many times in your show, you may have life. So, you know, once we can get out to these places, and this is going to cost a lot, and start drilling through the ice and sending something down, looking around, who knows what we're going to find? There may be life all over the solar system. We just don't know.
You talk about it being so far away. When I think of the orbit of Pluto, I'm reminded of when I was a kid going to either see the ice follies or the ice capades. You know where they had that the spinning line of girls?
Right.
And the one on the end is always trying to catch up?
Yeah, it's like when you put the coins in those big funnels
at
the amusement parks, you know how slowly they go when they're going around the rim. And, you know, Pluto's got a long orbit. It's 250 years that it takes to go around the sun once. So it's just a planet of such extremes. And I think one of the things exciting, even though it's not, I said planet, dwarf, but even though it's not the ninth planet anymore, it still feels like we sort of completed the reconnaissance of the solar system. There's plenty of other things to do and see. There's places to send robots and people, but this is kind of the real capstone for what started with the Mariners and Voyager so many years ago.
And with it being so far away, as you say, taking 250 years to go around the sun, daylight, I understand, is on Pluto is like dusk here.
Yeah, the sun's really, really small in the sky, so it's like late dusk.
Right.
It's dim twilight. By the way, I mentioned Mariner. I just wanted to mention to you, this is the day of the encounter was also the 50th anniversary, completely by coincidence, of Mariner 4 when it flew past Mars in 1965. So that's kind of a nice set of bookends. That was the first spacecraft. We had flown a spacecraft past Venus in 1962, but Mariner 4 was the first one that had a camera and almost went out there without a camera, but there are enough people that said, you know, we really need to see close up what we're looking at, that they ended up putting one on. So that was really, in so many ways, the first, and this built on that approach.
Now, New Horizons, it's not doing any orbiting. This is sort of like a drive-by. It's going to keep going, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to keep going. And there's a lot of conversation about that, because if they can find something else out there, because beyond the orbit of Neptune, you've got what's called the Kuiper Belt, which is this area of asteroids, comety material, a lot of icy small bodies and so forth, anything from dust particles up to things the size of Pluto and Eris. So there's a lot of stuff out there. So if they can find another target of reasonable size they can reorient towards, the plan is to change the trajectory with the fuel they have left and do another flyby. So sometime around 2019, 2020, we might have another one of these. And that's really exciting. Now, it's important to say that this isn't funded yet. So this is one of those things that NASA has to suggest to Congress, and they have to wring their hands and think about it and chew on it and make a decision. But really, at this point, this has generated such public attention that I think it's got to be kind of a slam dunk. I mean, you've got to do it, right?
So can this, even though it's a separate mission, it's a different situation from all other missions that are going on, including, you know, manned missions, can the buzz and the hype of this and the excitement rub off on some other missions that people are literally trying to get off the ground?
You know, I don't think you're the first person to ask that question. NASA might be asking that question. Pluto got a big boost when it got demoted from planet status. There are a lot of people upset about it. There were demonstrations. There were extremely angry letters sent to Mike Brown over Caltech saying, hey, how dare you? But it got a lot of notoriety, and now we've had this flyby and seen what an incredible and bizarre in many ways world that it is, that I think it will rub off. The question is, you know, where? Does it encourage more Mars exploration? That might be a hard connection for people to make, but certainly when you're talking about icy worlds out beyond the asteroid belt from Jupiter outward, I think it's going to get a lot more attention. And we've got the Europa Express coming up, which is going to take a look from on high at that world. It's not a lander, but that's an exciting mission. That's got preliminary funding. So I think there's going to be a boost of excitement about this. And what I'd like to see next, personally, is obviously the continued and complete funding for the Europa mission, but also a lander so we can get down, get through that ice, either with a drill or something that melts through it, some mechanism that gets us down into the water below, and see what's in there, because that's going to be amazing no matter what happens.
Well, could be the beginning of exciting times once again. I think the only people more excited than NASA these days are the folks at Disney. They're getting a lot of buzz, too.
Not over Tomorrowland, but yeah, I think they're pretty excited.
Just the name. Rod, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on with us once again.
Thanks very much.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. He's also the author of Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who made it happen. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0309, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. there could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Mark Saltzman, the author of Apple Watch for Dummies. He's a tech guru. Plus, Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, there is indeed an Idiot of the Day coming your way. Plus, right here, right now, much more stuff while news on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, we start off here in this second segment of the Stuff File News with the Darwin File. You know how this ends, don't you? Yeah. Authorities say a Dallas man accidentally killed himself while firing his gun in celebration of his 21st birthday party. Joseph Perez was pronounced dead early on Saturday after being taken to Methodist Hospital. Police say Perez was celebrating having turned 21 years old on Thursday when he grabbed a gun and began shooting. His family took the gun away from him, but Perez later retrieved it and accidentally shot himself. A police spokeswoman, Melinda Gutierrez, said alcohol was believed to be a factor in the shooting. Ah, yes. Once again, proof that the tree of life is often self-pruning. Stupid is often becomes stupid was. And let's talk about neighbors, shall we? Let's talk about the neighborly thing to do. A 28-year-old man was grilling on his apartment patio in Buffalo Grove, Illinois, when his upstairs neighbor asked him to stop. The man later said that if his neighbor had asked politely, he would have obliged him, but because of the neighbor's drunken belligerence, he decided to ignore him. The neighbor retorted by throwing a stool and chair down on the resident's patio, according to a police report. A few minutes later, there was a knock on the door downstairs. It was this same neighbor continuing to curse and demand his stool and chair back. Well, hey, pal, you threw it. You know what I'm saying? The resident stated that this neighbor then threatened to burn his apartment down. Now, police responded and spoke with the upstairs neighbor as he lit a second cigarette, all the while stating that the grill smoke bothers him. That's what the officer noted. He agreed that throwing items off his balcony towards the neighbor was probably a mistake. When asked about his threatening to burn the apartment down, he stated that he meant his neighbor's careless use of a grill would cause the fire. Well, that's probably just the alcohol talking, but what is the logic behind you basically threatening to burn down the home of the person who lives beneath you? I mean, don't you understand the basic principle of the direction of, you know, flames? Just asking. And moving right along, a man who allegedly tried to swipe a jouster's sword at a Colorado Renaissance festival was tackled by two women and held for police by a knight in shining armor. Witnesses said the man jumped into the jousting pen during a demonstration of the event in Larkspur and ran off with a sword. Stephen Chapman, who snapped photos of the incident and posted them to Facebook, said he saw the man being pursued by two women. A man held a sword and appeared to be playing keep away with two women. When one of the females shouted for security, I realized the moment was serious, Chapman wrote in his blog, which, by the way, his blog is tumbleweedtourist.com. Before onlookers could intervene, one woman ripped the stolen sword from the man, and another woman, dressed as a wench, tackled him to the ground, quickly applying a headlock. I photographed the incident from the time of the takedown to when the suspect was led away by authorities, said Chapman. The woman who tackled the man was soon relieved by a knight in shining armor, who happened to be, by the way, the woman's husband. The suspect, identified as 22-year-old Connor Ward, was charged with attempted assault on a police officer, resisting arrest, and theft. Police say Ward was drunk, of course he was drunk, and is a friend of the performers who tackled and held him. Talk about crime prevention old-school style, huh? Wow. 33-year-old Benjamin Urbelis was out on his boat with friends near Spectacle Island in Boston Harbor. As the group was swimming around the boat, the engine started and the propeller cut off 19-year-old Nicole Berthume's arm. Urbelis was arrested and charged with negligent operation of a boat and operating under the influence. Urbelis pleaded not guilty, claiming that though he had been drinking, he was swimming too and not on the boat when the incident happened. After further investigation, prosecutors charged 24-year-old law student Alexander Williams as the person who actually started the engine. But Williams's lawyer, Joe Serpa, said Williams was not a qualified boat captain and was in a panic. The only qualified operator of that boat jumped off, Serpa said. Anything that happened after that was a tragic accident. Urbelis' boat is named Not Guilty, as in N-A-U-T, guilty. Urbelis, by the way, is a part owner of a Boston place called the Julep Bar, Boston's Julep Bar, and is a drunk-driving defense attorney. Oh, the irony. Free round of juleps for every acquittal. I'm also guessing there will be a free round of civil suits when this one is all said and done. Yeah. The report to police in Boulder, Colorado sounded odd from the start. Some men, looking like students, were drinking while fishing from a canoe. Not so weird, except that the canoe was on top of a bus in the road, and the men were throwing money around. When officers arrived, they said the bus was parked, and while the men indeed had fishing poles, the money was bait, not being thrown around, and there was no evidence of drinking, so the officers left them alone. Or, as police spokesperson Lori Ogden put it, they were just having some fun, which apparently isn't illegal. Yet. Did anybody bother to ask just what they were fishing for, by the way? I'm curious to know. Aren't you? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, according to Henrico County, Virginia Sheriff Captain David Kinkle, had a citizen not alerted us to this, it's a situation that would have turned out much differently. A witness had reported two children, age 1 and 6, were left sitting in a car in a parking lot with the windows closed, with outside temperatures in the 90s. Investigations show that they were there for more than an hour. Their shirts were wet, sweat was rolling off their brows, Kinkle said. Deputies brought the kids inside and gave them cool drinks until their father showed up to pick them up. Their mother, 25-year-old Laquanda Newby, was arrested and charged with child abuse. The parking lot was for the Henrico County Courthouse. This is where it gets good, okay? This is the part that's hard to believe. Newby was there to turn herself in on a warrant for leaving her children in a car on a hot day while she was shopping. So this is not her first turn at the rodeo, folks. Not at all. It's time for Mr. Newby maybe to go shopping for a new wife. What do you think? Yeah. I mean, this woman is the classic definition of a slow learner. She's going to court because she has a case against her for leaving her children in the car. And what did she do at court? Leave her children in the car. And it's 90 degrees. Gosh, I wanted to make her the idiot of the day, but I did not. That comes later. But that woman, wow. Something's wrong there. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The Apple Watch is here, and for many, it is a game changer, a powerful computer that is worn on the wrist. But if you have one, what's the best way to use it with all that it can do? Tech expert Mark Saltzman has the answer because he's the author of Apple Watch for Dummies, and he joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Mark.
Hi, don't hold that against me. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So one of the things is, you know, everyone likes to get the new technology, but it's like I go back to the days when people first started getting websites. Every company said we needed to have a website, but they didn't know what to do with a website or what a website was for. Are we in that same kind of area with the Apple Watch? We all want one, but we don't know what we're going to do with it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's estimated that we only use about 10% of what our electronics can do anyways, and it's kind of like our brains, I guess. So whether it's a new camera that you bought or a TV that you mount to your wall or even a smartphone, chances are you're just scratching the surface of what it's capable of. So the whole idea behind the Dummies book for Apple Watch is that I help you unlock all the cool things and little-known features of this new wearable gadget, and even more so with a brand new category like a smartwatch. It's a relatively unfamiliar category for most, so that's even more reason for a book like this to just sort of make some sense of what it can do in plain English.
When you come up with a book like this, technology changes so quickly, and updates come out so fast for new technology. Do you worry when you write a book physically on paper that it won't be outdated by the time it comes to press?
Yeah, great point. So I wrote the book Siri for Dummies back in 2011, and thankfully it's still very much relevant today. And then we did do one update a year and a half after that. So it has a little bit more information. But you're right. Technology evolves so rapidly that once you put something down on paper, and by the way, the book is available as a digital download as well, you do risk it being obsolete, in a short period of time. That's the problem with any tech content. You know, I do TV shows and radio shows. It has to be, constantly updated or else it looks dated. There's still a show running called Gadgets and Gizmos that I hosted in the early 2000s. And I no word of a lie, I'm with Amber MacArthur, who's a well-known tech guru. She's amazing. And here I am holding up a gadget going, this is a brand new thing called an iPod, and it lets you store 1,000 songs. And they're still running it because I guess, these TV stations need the Canadian content. And I'm just slapping my forehead going, oh, my goodness. But you're right. I think that I covered so much in the book, however, 250-plus pages, that I do walk you through the essentials and many of the little-known things that the watch can do that you probably won't know out of the box.
Well, I'm just as guilty as well because I did a thing for CTV back in 1988, which is online, on the advent of the cell phone, which
awesome.
is out there for all to see. Now, with the Apple Watch, and the reason why I brought up that thing I did on the cell phone is because back then I spoke to somebody from Cantel, the precursor to Rogers. And they were talking about the so-called Buck Rogers wristwatch phone, which we now seem to have with the Apple Watch. But in reality, people were thinking about the cell phone on the wrist and that was going to be the wave of the future, where when you look at the generation that uses cell phones today, it is actually the cell phone in their pocket that eliminated the watch.
Yeah, and that's a bit of irony is that people say, why are we looking at a watch again when I gave up my watch for a mobile phone? But, I think that there's definitely a market for this. But what I've found is that many question the need for a wearable gadget like a smartwatch before they actually try it. And I was guilty of that as well. Even before I was approached to write the book Apple Watch for Dummies, I'm like, really? And by no means is Apple Watch the first smartwatch on the market, but I still was not sure if I would actually use something like this. It seemed a bit redundant or even lazy. How lazy can we get that you can't reach into your pocket to see the time or to see who's texting you? But I can tell you this, and for your listeners who haven't yet tried a smartwatch of any kind, that you really start growing reliant on this sort of bite-sized information that you don't have to hold at all. So when a call comes in or a text message, I can glance down at my wrist or an email, and with the text message, I can reply with my voice and send it as an audio clip or have it transcribed into text, and I can leave my phone in my pocket or in my backpack or in a purse, if you will. You start really liking this. And another example or application is directions. If you are trying to find, if you parked your car and you're trying to get to a meeting, you can ask your watch, take me to such and such address or such and such business. And not only will it give you turn-by-turn directions that you can glance at on your wrist with a map, but you can actually feel vibrations on your wrist that tell you when to turn left or right. So you don't even need to look down at all. So pretty cool stuff that a lot of people don't know about.
Wow. So that's just what I was going to ask you. You mentioned earlier that with a lot of technology, we only use about 10%. So what is some of the fascinating 10% that you can use with an Apple Watch? And more importantly, what's some of that 90% that people are not using that you think they should?
So I think a lot of the fitness applications are great because they give you motivation to be active. So it will count your steps and your calories and your heart rate monitors on the bottom of the Apple Watch. But a lot of people don't realize that there are third-party apps that will also monitor your sleep. It'll tell you how well you're sleeping and if you got up when and for how long and send all that information to an app or a website, which you can share with a physician, for example. There's also an inactivity feature. So if you're sitting idle for an hour, you will feel a slight vibration on your wrist and the words, to get up and stand up, to quote Bob Marley, to, give yourself a little bit of activity. And, I'm guilty of this. I'm a journalist. I sit behind a computer all day long. So I love the fact that you're not only told that you or reminded that you should get up, but it also calculates all that information. There's these like three rings that you're trying to fill out every day. So that's kind of the cool. So the fitness applications are one of the more, the smarter ones that you should definitely take advantage of. And to answer your first question, It's not available yet in Canada, which is probably why there's little buzz about it. But I love the fact that you can use your Apple Watch to make payments at retail. So I'm referring to this Apple Pay technology that's really popular now in the U.S., and it's coming to Canada later this year. And the idea is that you can just, you know, you're in line to buy something at a retailer or standing in front of a compatible vending machine, and you're just tapping your wrist to make that sort of that transaction, that digital handshake, all done securely where the retailer never even sees your credit or debit card information. It's all encrypted, and all they see are a random series of zeros and ones, all handled in the back end. But all you do is you tap your wrist on one of those contactless terminals, and the transaction is made. And you don't even need your iPhone nearby. Most of the things you do on Apple Watch, you still need a phone in some sort of proximity, but that's one of the applications where you don't need one.
Okay, so you get to write this book, Apple Watch for Dummies, so you get to really delve into what this thing can do, sort of like a third-party situation from Apple itself, who made it and might have blinders on as to what its capabilities are. So you just described some of the great things about it. In doing the research for the book, are there some things you found that you figure, you know, I'm not so crazy about this particular aspect?
Yeah, so, I mean, your watch can show you photos, but I don't really like looking at photos on an inch and a half screen. So I think that's a little silly. And on a related note, you can use your iPhone to snap a shutter on your iPhone. So if you want to take a selfie, but you can't quite reach for the shutter button while you're holding that phone extended, you can use your watch to snap the shutter. I don't really think that's a smart application, or I don't think it's going to be a popular one. But it's in there. You know, it's in there. Also, some other smartwatches let you use the watch like a phone and make calls and receive text messages without needing a nearby phone. So this watch does not let you do that. So I should be clear that unlike some other products, the Apple Watch does not let you. Like if you want to go for a jog, but you want to be accessible to your significant other, you still need an iPhone on you, which you may not want to bring if you're out for a run. But some watches let you put in a SIM card. But overall, I think, you know, I generally, you know, as a tech guy, I generally recommend not buying the first generation of anything. Always wait till the company works out the kinks, adds more features, and in some cases, drops the price. But I do think that for a first-gen product, Apple did a great job with Apple Watch. The early adopters bought the first couple of million. But you know, a lot of the analysts predict that 25 million of these things are going to sell the first calendar year. So I think that, you know, now is the time where the other people, the other folks who are somewhat interested, have to learn what it can do, and then maybe they'd be more inclined to grab one.
Okay, so you just mentioned 25 million potentially, and that was my next question, and that is, do you think this is something that is here to stay? I mean, just a little while ago, we were talking about Google Glasses. And they're still around, but we didn't see the explosion that was touted when that first came along.
Yeah, great point. And that is another example of a wearable technology. But in Google's defense, they never released it commercially. It was, you know, on a very sort of limited basis where you can order one, you apply for a $1,500 beta kit, if you will. It wasn't quite ready for prime time. So it, in all fairness, it wasn't on store shelves and not selling. It was something that, you know, geeks like me, early adopters with deep pockets, might have been interested in. I do think wearables are here to stay, to answer your question. I don't think Apple Watch is as a mainstream a product as, say, an iPad or an iPhone. That, I think, appeals to the masses. So I don't predict that smartwatches are going to be on everybody's wrist in Canada. I don't think so. But I do think that once you start getting used to the convenience of having something on your wrist, you travel a lot like me, you just hold out your arm and they scan the boarding pass on your wrist when you're walking, you know, up the tarmac, down to the plane, I should say. You know, it's just so convenient to glance down and see who's calling. Or all you do is you raise your wrist and you say, "Hey Siri, you know, what's the score of the Blue Jays game?" Or "What time is it in Italy?" And it's going to show you that information immediately. It's pretty awesome.
The book is called Apple Watch for Dummies. Mark, I thank you very much for being on the program with us. People can check out the website, which is www.dummies.com, correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tech expert Mark Saltzman, author of Apple Watch for Dummies. That website, again, is dummies.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0309. And you'll find links to the site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As we all marvel at the amazing pictures that a tiny spacecraft has sent to us from the farthest reaches of our solar system, it's a good time to think about all the ways we've benefited from space exploration, and might still in the future. Modern conveniences like cell phone cameras, scratch-resistant lenses for sunglasses, and water purification systems were all originally developed by NASA. Because of all the brilliant minds working there, it often seems like the only limit on what we can create is our own imagination. Unfortunately, one of the barriers to innovation is entirely man-made and unique to America: legal fear. Currently, a device invented by a former NASA engineer that could save lives by making it impossible to text, talk, or email on a cell phone while driving is being kept off the market, in large part because of fears about lawsuits. Let's be fair, there are actually many products that haven't made it to market because of concerns about the excessive litigation in America, and you would be amazed at what they can do. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, from somewhere under the covers, we have Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hey, Peter. You know what? There was a time about 3-4 years ago, I became an eBay fiend.
Okay.
And I would use eBay to supplement my book collection, particularly my Marx Brothers and James Bond book collections.
Right.
So, usually I'd have no problem, for most part, getting a certain volume that would catch my eye on eBay and pay a good price for it. But there were certain titles, like Harpo Marx's autobiography, Harpo Speaks, or the original British hardcover edition of Dr. No, that somehow precipitated some fierce bidding wars on eBay. And I remember you once told me, Peter, never to publicize that on Facebook because that would start the bidding war even further.
Yes.
And I did learn that lesson very well. Now, what would happen because of these fierce bidding wars over these very highly coveted books is that the price would reach such stratospheric heights that it'd be way too expensive for me to buy it. It would be too rich for my blood. So I would lose out on these books. And after such online bidding wars happened, I always ask myself, you know, what lengths would people go through in order to get a much coveted rare book for their collection?
Right.
Well, Stephen King, you know, mega selling author in his own right, and his books can sometimes fetch, you know, big prices depending on what the volume is. He answers that question in his own admittable way in his latest bestseller called Finders Keepers. Now, the book is a sequel to Mr. Mercedes, which was his first crack at writing a police mystery thriller and became a huge bestseller last year. It focuses on John Rothstein, an immensely popular J.D. Salinger type of author who's best known for his trilogy of novels featuring the rebellious Jimmy Gold. So in 1978, Rothstein undergoes a home invasion by a group of thugs led by Morris Bellamy, who is a devoted fan of the Jimmy Gold trilogy. And, you know, fan, you know what I mean? Like the fanatic kind of fan.
Right.
So Bellamy has another motive for paying such an unexpected visit to Rothstein. He's angry at the reclusive author for basically having Jimmy Gold sell out to the establishment and taking a job in an advertising firm. So in all that fear, Rothstein divulges to Bellamy that he has a trunk filled with moleskin notebooks that with a whole bunch of new writings, including manuscript to two new Jimmy Gold novels. So what does Bellamy do? He seizes his golden opportunity. He takes the notebooks, that are in the trunk, all the moleskin notebooks, and $20,000 in cash also, before he kills Mr. Rothstein in cold blood. Now we flash back 30 years ahead. We flash forward, sorry, 30 years ahead. And there's a high school student named Peter Saubers who accidentally stumbles upon the trunk and the site where the trunk is buried with, you know, which Bellamy buried before he was arrested and sentenced to jail for the murder. So he uses the found $20,000 in the trunk to support his parents gradually so they can endure some, so they can, you know, withstand some serious financial problems. But for the notebook, Saubers realizes they're a high commercial value. So 5 years after that discovery, Bellamy is paroled and is released. But his passion for those lost, rusty notebooks hasn't wavered, and neither his dogged determination to recover the buried trunk with them. So when he finds out that young Peter Saubers has unearthed the trunk and has taken advantage of its contents, as well as the trying to sell the coveted notebooks to a shady local rare book dealer, he is even more determined to recover his literary treasures and will go through any means, whether it be violent or not, to wrest them from young Saubers' hands. Now, this is where Bill Hodges, who is the hero of Mr. Mercedes, comes into the picture. He, using his street smarts and his certain methods of crime investigation, a small team of offbeat assistants, Hodges gets involved in another race against time to stop Morris Bellamy's pursuit of recovering the hidden Rossi notebooks before more innocent people pay for it with their lives. Now, this book sort of echoes the themes of iconic author versus fanatically dangerous fan that was explored so hauntingly well in King's novel Misery. And while Bellamy's anger is directed at an action lead character and the author creates those actions, Finders Keepers decides to focus on the dangerous pursuit of the hidden material legacy of the iconic John Rothstein, whether it be for satisfying a fan's or literary pleasure for greed or substantial gain. And it gives an interesting look behind the making of a fanatic and the factors that motivates one to pursue their interests, although it can and does border on the violent. So all in all, Finders Keepers is quite an enjoyable mystery thriller and psychological criminal profile compressed between two covers. And for those who make writing popular books or articles for publications their main line of work, it will still have you wearily looking over your shoulder when someone goes up to you and say that they're your biggest fan.
I'm almost afraid to ask. Actually, let me get to the question first. So this latest book is...
It's called Finders Keepers by Stephen King, and it's published by Scribner's, and it's $39.99.
And again, I'm almost afraid to ask, since I always do ask this question when you review a book, what other books do you suggest based on what you were talking about today? But you know, we're talking about Stephen King. It's like asking you, give me another Pierre Burton title. You know, it's like I'm afraid to see how many trees you're going to kill.
Well, for this one, we're going to stick with Misery because the themes are almost the same. Fanatical fan and, you know, popular author, sometimes reclusive or eccentric author. And it was a thin book compared to some of his other magnum opus. But also another book that King wrote called On Writing, which not only focuses on how to be a writer, but also talks about what it's like to be a very popular writer. And I think it's his most personal book, and it's also a thin volume too. So you have a little bit of fictional Stephen King and a little bit of nonfiction Stephen King.
And what was that second title you just mentioned? Because we lost you just for a hair when you said the title. What was the name of it?
It's called On Writing.
On Writing. Okay, great. Yeah. And again, this week's book is?
Called Finders Keepers by Stephen King. Published by Scribner's, and it's $39.99.
And you know, I'm imploring people to buy the book because we know that, you know, Stephen King's on hard times.
Oh yeah, he needs the money. Yeah, so please help him out.
You know, it's that persistent writer's block that he has.
I know. Yeah, and the sales from his previous books just won't help him. Doesn't cut it.
I guess he's the antithesis to Harper Lee. Yeah.
Oh, big time.
Anyway, thank you very much, Stuart. How can people find you?
Well, they won't find me in Maine, that's for sure. But they can find me in the Montreal Times every week in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Thank you, Peter. And you don't happen to know any Annie Wilkes by any chance, do you?
No, I don't.
Good. Thanks.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just into the home stretch here on the Stuff File program. We have just one more item to get through on this week's show. So you know, boys and girls, if you're a regular listener to this program, you know exactly what that is, right? Yes, at this juncture of the program, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
This one is short and sweet. No muss, no fuss. Here we go. 33-year-old Christopher Foray pleaded guilty in Pittsburgh in April to 6 bank robberies. The first 4 in which surveillance video revealed him to have a reddish beard, and the last 2 in which the video revealed him to be wearing a fake red beard covering his reddish beard. Foray did not explain why he had the fake beard over the real red beard. Well, really, no explanation is needed when you think about it, because there's only one reason why someone would want to disguise their real red beard with a fake red beard, and that reason is, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0309. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0309. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.